interview at the New York State Military Museum, Saratoga Springs, New York. It is the 20th of April, 2006, approximately 10 a.m. Interviewers are Wayne Clark and Mike Russert. Could you give me your full name, date of birth, and place of birth, please?
William Stewart Allison, Elizabeth, New Jersey, 122941.
What was your educational background prior to entering service?
I went to elementary school and junior high school in Bergen County, Hackensack, New Jersey. My high school years were in Clinton, New York, and I went to Auburn University on an NROTC scholarship. That's how I got my commission.
Okay. What branch of service did you enter?
Navy.
And when did you enter?
I was commissioned on the 18th of December, 63.
Okay. Where did you enter service?
The commissioning ceremony was at Auburn, Alabama.
Okay.
Same day. I got commissioned same day I graduated.
Okay. What was your date of discharge?
I think it was the 1st of May of 84.
What was the highest rank that you held?
Lieutenant Commander, 04. Sadly.
All right. Why did you decide to join the Navy ROTC program?
Not by accident, but I had, I was fiercely independent when I was growing up, oldest of three boys. I had taken all the different scholarship exams that were available in high school, among them Merit, GE, Procter & Gamble, Regents, and then the Navy. And then I had applied to different engineering schools, which is what I had intended to go into, was electrical engineering. I'm trying to think of them in the order, my choices for the ROTC program once I was given that choice. Purdue, MIT, Stanford, Brown, Georgia Tech, and Rensselaer. So I was accepted at those schools as a civilian student, but in the process, and then I was awarded the Navy scholarship, which was the only one that I could take out of state. The others were all ones that I could get a partial scholarship if I stayed in New York State. And as I said, I was kind of independent, wanted to get away, did not want to do what I had seen some of my upperclassmen do, and that was go off to school and then come back on weekends, you know, to visit with the same guys that they had gone to school with and do laundry and so on. So I did want to take the Navy scholarship and was thinking that I was going to go to one of these first five choice schools. And as I sent my little acceptance slip around via mail to the schools, I was given notice that the small units at the different Navy ROTC units were closed for out-of-state students.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I got the slip to Rensselaer, their unit was completely closed out for everybody, out-of-state and in-state. So the Navy sent me a card and said, where would you be willing to go to school? And I checked all the blocks, and Auburn's considered the overflow for east of the Mississippi, so that's where I ended up being sent.
Okay. After you were commissioned at Auburn, where did you go from there?
Straight to Pensacola. In my sophomore year, I was given the option of a flight indoctrination program, they called it, and I think it was pretty clever on the part of the military. You know, they pay $600 for you to get your private license to find out if you're aeronautically adapted. And they tell you, you know, if you get orders to flight training, you have to accept them, because in the Navy, subs and the air are voluntary. Otherwise, you just go on board ship. And so, you know, at that point in my young life, I couldn't imagine why I would not want to go fly, so I said, of course. And I did get orders to flight training, so I went out to Pensacola on the 2nd of January.
Had you always been interested in flying?
Not particularly. I was not one of these guys like you hear about, you know, that stood and went to every Blue Angel show and, you know, would bicycle for miles in Nebraska, you know, to get to some airfield to watch the Blues. And I did, you know, build a couple of model airplanes. In fact, I related recently about building one. I think it was an old SPAD, and it had a little 49 Cub engine on the front of it, and I made one up and one straight back down into the dirt, and that was the last fly-by-wire that I did.
When you reached Pensacola, what kind of training did you receive?
You have about 3 months of ground school. Mm-hmm. And they cover naval history, navigation, engineering, aerodynamics, weather, meteorology, and so on. And upon successful completion there, then you start primary. And that's in the, that was, and it still is actually, it's in the T-34. Back then it was the T-34B, which was a six-cylinder reciprocating engine. Now I think they use a turbo engine in the T-34, but it's a tandem cockpit, fore and aft. Instructor sits in the back, student sits in the front. And you get about 30 hours, and during which time you solo. And then depending on the needs of the service, as you've probably heard that term many, many times in your interviews, but you can go either jets or props. And back at the time that I graduated, I was in a class of 64. And I think most everybody finished pre-flight. I do know there were a few guys that didn't make it, but I think roughly 60 people. There were only two seats to jets. And I got one of them. So I went to Meridian, Mississippi for basic, and I was in the T-2B, which was a single engine. Again, tandem cockpit. But now this is the first time, you wear an oxygen mask and sit on an ejection seat, and that was a straight wing jet. And then 6 months later, headed down to Kingsville, Texas. There were two advanced bases, Kingsville, Texas and Beeville, Texas, where I completed flight training. It takes about a year and a half to go through flight training, or it did at that time. I think they shortened it a little bit. And I flew the F-9. And then the F-11, which at that time had just been retired as the airplane that the Blues were flying. So it was really kind of a slick aircraft. It was afterburner, single seat. So your first flight in the airplane is you by yourself.
Obviously you liked flying.
By that time I was doing well. And I had always been mechanically inclined as a kid. And it seemed to come pretty naturally. I did enjoy it and I was good.
Do you think, in retrospect, what you learned there trained you, prepared you for Vietnam, air combat, and
well,
what you did in Vietnam?
Without being critical of the other services, let's see, answer the question. Yes, flight training in the Navy is rigorous, but I think probably flight training in the Air Force is fairly rigorous as well. It's a different philosophy. The Air Force handbook, the -1, tells them what they can do. It's fairly lengthy and it gives all the different things that they can do. In the Navy, you've got like five or six sentences in the middle of the NAFOPS manual, training standardization manual. It tells you the things you can't do and everything else they want you to do. They want you to try. They're willing to lose an aircraft every now and then for people to press the envelope. And I think jumping ahead in my answer to you, after I'd been in the service, I learned that, and of course I flew attack aircraft, the way most military aviators are evaluated has to do with the way their fighter pilots, fly. But of the world's air forces, I think the reputations are as follows. I think the Israelis are the best fighter pilots. I think the Aussies and the Brits are second and we're third. But my training was rigorous. Of course, it was for carrier-based, and that's not the same as landing on a 12,000-foot strip either, like the Air Force. And they grease their landing zone. We make full sink rate landings. So there is a difference, and I think that I am proud that I have Navy training.
When did you make your first carrier landing?
Well, it was probably sometime in '64.
Could you describe the sensation of leaving a carrier in a catapult?
Yeah, I can tell you about that. They, by comparing it to the landing, because they really, really psych you for the landing, and you have 3 or 4 weeks of intensive, maybe three flights a day with 12 or 14 practice landings on a, what they're called FCLPs, field carrier landing practice. They're a little bit more difficult than a carrier landing, to be very honest, because the carrier is always into the wind. But when you're doing your practice landings, you can have a crosswind. In any event, you practice and practice and practice and practice. In the Navy, we fly the ball. It's just a visual indication of where we are in glide slope. And you have to be on speed. Speed is very important, so you don't pull the resting cable out of the ship or the hook out of the baticated airplane. So we land, and the angle of attack gauge is calibrated, which is what we use for speed. It's a correlation on weight. It's a calibration of approach speed based on your weight. And we basically are flying within a quarter of a knot of our prescribed speed for coming aboard. In any way, to answer your question, they really psych you for the landing. The only thing they tell you about the cat shot, which is what you get second, because you land first. Mm-hmm. So you fly out to the ship, you make your couple of practice touch and goes, and then you make your first trap. And like I said, you're so psyched for that. I can also tell you a small story about that, but the earphone cord at that time was external to the microphone system, and so it came down and hung around and plugged into a little pigtail that was coming out of the oxygen hose. So it was sort of loose. And one of the things that you're supposed to do on your landing checklist is check harness locked. And apparently I did not check that my harness was locked for my first trap. And on landing, I went very far forward, and when I did, the cord under the g-forces of the landing went forward and hooked on the gun sight, which has got a round barrel on the left side of it for adjusting. And of course, the throttles, when you land on a carrier, you're taught, you go full power and bring your speed brakes in, that's so that in case you miss a wire, you go back around again. So I'm sitting there at full throttle, and I couldn't get my arm back to pull the throttle back because I was trapped with my head stuck up against the gun sight. And the air boss came up on the radio and he said, "That's okay, son, you can pull the power back, you're aboard now." Anyway. The only thing they tell you for the catapult shot is make sure your head is against the headrest, that you've got your flaps set to takeoff position, because that's different from your landing, and to grab the catapult grip, which is a grip that you grab to keep the throttles from coming back. They don't tell you anything about what the ride is going to be. And back at the time that I carrier qualified, they used hydraulic catapults, where you pretty much got all of the bang was right there at the beginning. And then the airplane, which, you know, would stretch, kind of caught up to the catapult, and not literally, but it was a big hit. Now, of course, the catapults are steam catapults, and even though it's still a heavy hit, it's a much more gradual acceleration. Still get to the same end speed. But there was not a lot of, nobody talked about, everybody was concerned about making a good landing. Nobody was talking about making a good catapult, because mm-hmm. you're just a guest on the shot. Once the thing fires, you know, your eyeballs roll into the back of your head, and you kind of focus somewhere, 300 or 400 yards in front of the ship, and hopefully the nose is above the horizon, and away you go.
Okay. When were you were assigned eventually to A6s?
I went.
Do you volunteer for an A6, or well, were you assigned?
More or less volunteered. It was very, very strange. I've told the story before, but I did not realize there was a war going on in Vietnam. I was not a student of history or political science or current events. And each decision point along the way, for example, I could have selected helicopters. I could have selected multi-engine right out of Pensacola because I had good grades and I was allowed to select it. I selected jets. Well, that puts me a step closer. And then when I was in Kingsville, I had a choice of selecting attack or fighter. And my understanding of what fighters did was they drilled circles in the sky. You know, they were high up in the air and they just drove around in circles. But I really liked the attack role, which we had been exposed to because we fly low and fast. We were chasing cows on the King Ranch at that time. That was okay to do. So I really liked attack. I liked the mission. Plus, there was an incentive at that time. I mentioned that the F-11, which was my class, was the last class to fly the F-11 at Kingsville. It was a single seat and it had an afterburner. And those people who were going to go to attack got to fly their last two stages, tactics and air-to-air gunnery, in the F-11. If they were not going to go, they were not going to get orders to fighters, you know, upon getting their wings. So I said, I'd like to fly the F-11, and I really don't want to fly fighters in the fleet. I didn't think I did. I wanted to fly attack. So I elected attack. So I got to fly the F-11. And about the time that I came out of Kingsville, they had been losing a lot of aviators in Vietnam. And prior to my arrival in the A-6 training squadron at Oceana, it's called the RAG, Replacement Air Group, and the squadron was VA-42. They considered the aircraft, it was the newest aircraft in the Navy's fleet, and it had been designed for jungle interdiction. It was considered a complex aircraft, and they did not want to put first tour aviators in it, in other words, a newly designated aviator. So that up until I was ordered to the VA-42, the folks that were sent there were all second tour aviators. They already had prior experience either in the A-4 or the A-3 or vigilante. In some manner, they had flown another operational aircraft. So I was virtually the first nugget pilot into A-6s. And it turns out the aircraft...
What do you mean by the term nugget pilot?
Newly designated. Brand new, wet behind the ears. No operational experience. All I've done is fly in the training command with people yelling at me and beating on the back of my head with a knee board. But I went to VA-42, and the aircraft itself is a very, very easy to fly aircraft. The system was what was complex, the weapon system. That was operated by a guy who sat now I'm in an airplane with side-by-side seating for the first time. Everything has been tandem, but had two people prior to that. And the Bombardier Navigator, that was the designation in the A-6 for our NFO, Naval Flight Officer. He had a radar and a computer, and the pilot had the flight controls. And probably saved my life having a second person there on numerous occasions. I probably saved his life on, some occasions.
Was it hard to get used to that side-by-side configuration?
Well, no, because you see, everything prior to that had been training. Mm-hmm. And so this was now an operational aircraft, so I didn't have any comparison operationally. I understood why we flew the aircraft that we flew in the training command. They were all designed as training aircraft. And this was an operational aircraft, and it was great. And when I first got to the aircraft, in actuality, there was no limitation on having that right seat filled. But shortly after I finished the RAG, I went to my first operational squadron, which was VA-75. One of the pilots took off without anybody in the right seat in a hurry and ended up crashing and nearly losing his life. And at that point, then they made a quick NATOPS change recommendation that the right seat would always be occupied by a qualified right seat, either a Bombardier Navigator, an NFO, or at that time we had some enlisted flight crew that could get qualified. They had to know how to operate the air conditioning system. There were a couple of circuit breakers to his right shoulder that he had to understand the use of them in emergency procedures, and then the ejection seat, get an ejection seat qualified. But I do have some flights in my logbook where I was not accompanied, which is, a rarity. And I've flown all models of the aircraft. The A-6A, which was the original version. The A-6B, of which there were six, which was a modification that was designed to fire the Standard Arm missile, which was supposed to be a great improvement over the Shrike, which was an anti-radiation missile against the missile sites. The controlling radars for the missiles, surface-to-air missiles. I flew the A-6C, which was the predecessor to the E, and that had mounted to the airframe a blivet on the center line. The A-6 had five stations, and this was on the center line, and it had the predecessors for the A-6E radar and tram. It had a low light level TV and it had an infrared sensor. And at that time I was in VA-176, and the skipper was the first NFO naval flight officer to be a CO. He had picked me out of the rag to be his pilot. I was back there on my second tour as an instructor. He wanted me to be his pilot, and he knew we were going to have these three aircraft to evaluate. And I had some really interesting flights in the A6C, triple cycles where you leave the ship and don't come back at the end of your normal 1.5, which in the daytime turns out to be about a 1.7 because of loiter time and at the end of the pack and so on, because we had very good fuel specifics, so we always landed last. But we triple cycled. We used to fly from the Western Mediterranean and fly all the way over to the Kithra Anchorage, where at that time we were in the Cold War, and that's where the Russian vessels were anchored, near the Peloponnesus, and we would fly over at high altitude and then drop down 100 miles to the west and get 100 feet off the water and fly in and surprise them and catch them with all of their intelligence array of antennas, out from under wraps and whatever armaments they might have on board. So we would take back some infrared and low light television intelligence. Interesting flights. Mm-hmm. Tough on your butt.
In what way?
Triple cycle. Yeah, 6 hours, 6.5 mm-hmm. hours. Mm-hmm. And that's the ejection seat by design is extraordinarily hard. You can't have any cushioning in the seat because right. If you were sitting like on a 1-inch thick foam pad, the seat has that 1 inch to accelerate, and then if it hit you at that time, it'd break your back. So you're sitting on a very, very hard seat.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you ever run into many electronical problems with the A6? I know
sure.
They had to be serviced quite a bit.
The A6A was, because it was the first, mm-hmm. The first few deployments, fraught with problems. We had fuel leaks because it was a wet wing aircraft.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Fuel is, there were three fuel cells in the fuselage, but then we also had 7,000 pounds of fuel in the wings. And it was just the skin of the wing as riveted to the I-beam that pretty much made up, the wing fuel cells. You could dump that fuel if you had to. But we had a lot of fuel leaks, we had a lot of hydraulic leaks, and then the system. The system was, by the time it got to the fleet, it was fairly antiquated. We had an actual mechanical drum computer, and it would freeze. When you take an aircraft to altitude, whatever moisture is in it freezes, and you have a very efficient air conditioning systems. They pull a lot of the moisture out. If you want to be warm in the cockpit, though, you end up intentionally introducing that moisture back in, and it would freeze in the drum of the computer. And if you talk to a bombardier navigator from the old school, they'll talk about kicking the base of the computer, and they were kicking it not out of frustration, they were kicking it to free it up, because it was in the pedestal between their legs, mm-hmm. which is where they had their slew stick on the top of it with their little keyboard, and they would kick it to try to to unfreeze it so that it would start to rotate again, because they could put data in manually on the keyboard, and then this thing had to at least make one rotation in order for that data to be picked up and stored, and they were constantly kicking it. So we did have problems with that. We also, the original versions of the A6 had a search radar and a track radar, and it was very difficult to keep the track radar working, so we ended up most of the time just in the search, in the some of the variations of the search mode for the bombardier navigator. If you had an aircraft that was going west to Vietnam, you got the highest supply support, and all the assets were going west. So the very first cruise that I made was in A6s that went to the Mediterranean. We were raped of all of our assets, really. We ended up flying what they called partial system A6s, just to take all of the components and send them west to support the squadrons that were in the Gulf of Tonkin.
No, were you always on the Kitty Hawk, or were you on
Squadrons change from air wing to air wing, but mm-hmm. On my very first deployment, I was in Air Wing 7. We were on Independence in the Mediterranean. On the next deployment, I was still in VA-75, but now I was in Air Wing 11 on the Kitty Hawk, and that went west. The composition of the air wings changes, the different squadrons. Mm-hmm. They try to keep them the same so that the wing commanders, there's some continuity that way with tactical notes and doctrine and policies.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How close, were you and the Bombardier Navigator always together, the same?
The idea is to let folks float around in the workups, what they call workups, before you went on a deployment, until perhaps halfway through, two-thirds of the way through, and then they would crew you up. And that the idea being then that you'd start to work as a team. But it was not exclusive. If my Bombardier Navigator had duty, I was still going to fly. They were still going to use me as pilot and send me out, so they'd fly me with another Bombardier Navigator. And there was, you know, we had 20 crews when we went west. Only, I think, either 12 or 15 when we went east. But probably there was somebody who was sick or somebody who was down for some reason, mm-hmm. or couldn't fly or had other responsibilities. And I'm only going to mention one thing. I was a good pilot, and I ended up getting anybody. And I got BNs that wouldn't fly with other pilots, and I got BNs who got sick flying with other pilots because they were nervous. And I was kind of the... They would put anybody with me because I enjoyed teaching. Mm-hmm. And I could make anybody comfortable in the aircraft.
When was your first combat mission?
In the end of December of 67.
What was it?
It was what we called a road recce. The executive officer of the squadron and his bombardier and I went out, and we were on Route 15. We were going to go from south to north, ingress wherever we ingressed, and fly up doing road recce, like road reconnaissance, and if we found targets of opportunity, drop, you know, a couple bombs. We were carrying 500-pound bombs. And then, you know, egress to the north and head back to the ship. And I do remember that particular flight. It was kind of funny. I think about it many times. I had flown one of the A-6Bs over to the ship. I did not ride the ship over to the Gulf, as did one of the other crew. So I didn't have the first week on the line. And we had already lost one crew by the time I got there. Anyway, the story, you know, always hear the stories about, you know, the AAA as a threat and the SAMs as being a threat. But the small arms, if you got below 3,000 feet, it was the small arms, it was the rifles that could, you know, just one lucky pot shot, you know, could do enough damage to the aircraft that you'd have to eject. And if you had to eject, that was the real problem, because you didn't want to be captured, mm-hmm. Especially in the south. And we were operating, those very first few flights were operating right between the south and the north. And anyway, long story short, I knew that I had to jink. You had to jink. Jinking is, you know, pulling hard and changing altitude and heading and so on as you work your way up the route to keep from anybody from being able to get a bead on you with their rifle, with these small arms. So the executive officer briefed me. He said, you know, I'll kiss you off as soon as we go in, and you go ahead and make, you know, one 360-degree turn. That'll put you 4 minutes behind me. Just keep me in sight. And he said, what I'll do is, he said, I'll call the target for you as I fly over it, and then you go ahead and pop up and do a roll-in on it, and then I'll fall in behind you, and then you identify the next target and so on. So he was starting to head up, and I'm jinking. I'm back there jinking. And I'm jinking left, and I'm jinking right, and I'm going up, and I'm going down. Next I said, I've got a target up here. You got me in sight? I said, that's negative. He said, where are you? I said, well, I'm over Route 15. He said, this is where I am. He identified where. Anyway, the whole idea of this thing was that I was barely making any forward progress up the highway. I was jinking. I was just doing all of these things, just trying mm-hmm. to keep from getting shot. There were no small arms, and he was just basically, he was flying up the road looking for targets of opportunity. Mm-hmm. So he was opening the distance. That was just kind of one of those funny things that happens. Mm-hmm. But once I got used to the fact that this was a hostile environment, and you knew what you had to do and what you didn't have to do, and that was one of the things you didn't have to do. Mm-hmm.
Were you ever wounded or injured?
No.
How about your plane never take much damage?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
What was it from, small arms in aircraft fire, SAM?
AAA. Never from a SAM. Mm-hmm. Had a piece of a tree in my leading edge of the wing one time, so I presumed that I was flying kind of low on that one. And we actually had sustained damage. We were so short of ordnance that we were now using some of the old World War II Air Force ordnance. And I forgot what the designation was. I think it was a Mark 117 or something like that. But they were very unstable bombs when they came off of a modern weapons platform like the A-6 was. And we sustained damage, you know, when the fins would strike the empennage of the aircraft, and which could have been dangerous. But the couple of times that I had that sort of that damage, it was just skin damage on the empennage, but it was definitely identifiable as from our own bomb.
Do you ever have a time that you thought you would have to eject?
There were a couple. One was, took a round in the front windscreen, and I couldn't see. It was in the daytime, but I couldn't see out of the front. And you have to be able to see out the front to make a fair landing. And anyway, the long and the short of it was that we made several passes at the ship, and then one under the control, on my own control, because I was trying to make what's called a Corsair pass, and I was to keep the airplane wrapped up so that I always had the wing down. I could always see the landing area until right at the very last minute to roll out to land. And I tried two or three of those, and you have to carry a lot of extra power to do that. And when I rolled out, you're also taught, you know, not to pull power once you're across the ramp. That's just one of the things that you're taught. So I pulled power, but I never pulled it up, and I always was boltering. I was always touching down long from the four wire, which was the last wire. Then the LSO said that, you know, if we give him a chance, he would try to control me in. I just listened to him, and he'd control me in. My BN could see, but the bombardier navigator's seat was to the a little bit down and a little bit aft from the pilot seat. And when you came aboard, you wanted your seat all the way down, if you could possibly do it, so that it was in a proper position for ejection. Because if you had your seat raised way up and your head was up above the face curtain, you were creating another problem for yourself. And that is where your head would hit the canopy before the seat did and break a neck. So I think my BN could see, but I'm not sure how much he was able to help me with the approach. In any event, the LSO gave me a bad call in close, and he said, "You're left." And that the implication there is that I had to come to the right. And when I came to the right, I could see the landing area. And that meant that the island structure of the carrier was right in front of me. Mm-hmm. And I pulled up really, really hard and missed the tack-in antenna, which is the top element on the ship's island. And, you know, there's an instant when, you know, you say, okay, that was almost it. But you have to calm right back down again. I mean, it's automatic. You just, everything goes right back down to normal. You need to focus on the problem. The problem is getting aboard, and I was getting low on fuel. And I came back around and made another Corsair pass and pretty much just took a cut and just pulled the throttles all the way back to land and got aboard. But that was one time when that was there was a possibility. I mean, you know, you don't like to admit it at the time. And then I had another situation when I was in VA-176 years later, where we had problems with the flight controls through the autopilot and some of the wiring and the way a particular cable had been installed with a bent pin. And normally you have, if you move the stick a little bit, you get a little bit of deflection of the flight control. If you move it a lot, you get a lot. But in this particular situation, when you move the stick, you got full deflection. So I was going to get either a full rate roll to the right or a full rate roll to the left. And I was actually in timing. I was using rudder to keep the nose above the horizon as the airplane was rolling, and I was becoming more divergent. I was rolling. Each time the rolls were going farther and farther away from normal. And I knew I was going to have to call for the ejection from my bombardier first. I had to get him out of the airplane. And I knew that I couldn't tell him to eject when I was upright, because by the time he responded and the seat reacted and so on, he would be pretty much going out, you know, like this, and this was becoming worse and worse and worse. And I didn't want to use the word eject when I talked to him, because a part of, you know, like prepared to eject, because if he only heard part of the transmission, he might go right then. So I said, you know, we're going to have to get out, and I'll call it for you. This all happened automatically. I mean, here I am still wrestling with the airplane. We're less than 200 feet above the water in the front of the ship. I'm trying to gain control of the aircraft. I knew I didn't have control of the aircraft. I knew it was just a matter of time before we were going to have to get out. Now, I'm going to back up. I've always been very mechanically oriented, always been interested in the machine. And during our pre-flight brief, before he ever left the ready room, I noticed in the previous 10 yellow sheet stubs, which is what you look at to see what's the history of the aircraft, I noticed that there were several maintenance complaints. Mm-hmm. On the computer power, the generators, one tripping the other. And something about the autopilot. Somebody had written something about the autopilot. And in my head, when I got all done, I simply said to my BN, I said, you know, yeah, if you have a problem with the autopilot, or if your system, you know, dumps off the line, just turn the computer off. I just remember making that kind of matter-of-fact statement to him. We didn't have to get out. During one of these rolls, he turned the computer off, and I ended up with a normal airplane. In our debrief, he said, I just thought you were testing the airplane. He did not realize that I was in extremis. Okay. But that part worked out. Now, if you've ever had an airplane to react to you like that, you do not believe that you have a good airplane anymore. I mean, I was right now on pins and needles. So I made a nice long straight, and we called for a pull forward, called for an emergency approach, which I think probably the only time I ever called for that in my career. And they clear what they do is they pull all the aircraft forward and clear the landing area. And I made a long straight, and the airplane responded okay. But I was prepared to get out of the airplane at any moment. Mm-hmm. But there were other times. I mean, I've had fire warning lights and such. But those were the ones that I think I can remember now.
How many combat missions did you fly?
I think there was 759 or something like that. I'm sorry, that's carrier landings. I was totally wrong. That's carrier traps. 109 or something like that.
How many of them were to the north?
All your missions were north? All were in the north, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What were your missions, what were your targets most of the time, majority of the time?
It's, you know, I don't want to get political about this thing. This is a terrible war, the way it was fought, much the way people, I think, are criticizing our current war. And for very similar reasons, but at that time, all of the targets were actually approved by the White House, by executive, on a day-to-day basis. We were bombing road intersections just to make potholes or to bring dirt down. Our job was to interdict the supply lines from the north into the south. That's what the ultimate task was. So, you know, the powers to be believed that if we impeded, you know, if we blocked a road, that we would stop this. Well, they had, you know, many, many, many thousands of people with shovels and bicycles and picks, and, you know, if we stopped jeeps, you know, they dig a bike path and they carry, you know, two bombs on a bicycle. It didn't make any difference. We were really not making any dent, I don't think, personally. I think we should have either mined Haiphong Harbor, and that was off limits. Just told whatever ships that were there, they were stuck unless they left. You know, just give them 24 hours notice and get out. Just mine the harbor. And then do what we did in 75, just basically 10 days of bombing, and that brought them to their knees in 75. Why didn't we bring them to their knees in 65? It's just, you know, but that's in retrospect. Mm-hmm. That's at the time, the targets that we bombed were, I consider, pretty inconsequential. We did hit power plants, we did hit dams, we did hit communication sites, and it was you kind of did what you were told. And I was a young lieutenant, and I wasn't evaluating the targets. Mm-hmm. Back then, I was just, my name was on the flight schedule. My bombardier and I would, you know, plan the flight, and we'd go in. Now, did we have our own take on it? Absolutely. I was excited by, once I got used to the fact that, you know, we were in an environment where people were shooting at us, okay, and that didn't take long. I mean, you kind of get used to that pretty quickly. But then I started wanting to be clever. Now, if I told you that on five nights in a row that, okay, what they would do is they would determine for a specific target how many tons of ordnance they wanted on the target. Okay. So if it turned out that they were going to use the A6, which they did almost all the time for these night strikes, almost exclusively, we would sometimes take A7s on our wing to get an increased number of bombs, if you will. They were almost just like weapons extenders for us. Okay. And we would just call, you know, and say, okay, stand by, you know, hack, and everybody would drop their bombs. That would just get more ordnance on the target at the same time. But let's just say that they determined that X amount of ordnance had to go on. That turned out to be five A6 sorties. We carried 18 Mark 82s at night. We carried 22 in the daytime. The airplane was capable of carrying 28 the way we configured it, and the Marines took the forward main landing gear doors off, which inhibited the forward inside racks of MERS Station 2 and 4, and they could get 30. They could actually load 30 bombs, the full complement of bombs, a 500-pound bombs on five racks. So if it was going to take five, somebody was going to be assigned the first night. And generally went to one of the more senior crew for the first time into a target. And I remember this happened to be a railroad yard, some sort of transshipment point. It was near one of the little windy rivers or something. And what happens is they go in, they drop their bombs. They come back and they debrief. Okay. And then the next afternoon, another crew is going to be assigned that target. And the Navy, in its infinite wisdom, you know, they assign at the same time, same bomb load, okay? So the crew number one hands their planning to crew number two. Crew number two says, this is great, because we don't have to go through all the drawing the lines and cutting the charts and taking them together. Okay, I've got it ready built. You know, thanks a lot. You know, what did you see? Hey, they shot at us here, they shot at us there. Danny and I were the fifth night. And I said, why don't we do something different? Why don't we go in where they're coming out, and go out where they came in, and that way they're going to be looking elsewhere. And it absolutely worked that way. It was absolutely phenomenal, because as we coasted in, all the AAA lit up right at the other spot where everybody else had come in. Over the target, they're shooting at the other end of the target. When we crossed the target, they were shooting at the first end of the target where we'd already been. And when we coasted out, they were shooting where we had come in. So they also got used to us doing things. So I started really enjoying being clever. Mm-hmm. And did the same thing with most of my ingress, just when I would cross from the water to the land. I would cross always going due west. And then I would alter my heading over a SAM site. I know that sounds hard to believe, but most people were trying to fly between SAM sites, which gave, if you have two SAM sites here and they have their envelopes like this, they're flying, they're getting two looks, two different SAM sites are able to look. And you have the longest distance to transverse like this, where they can track, they can get a bead on you. Mm-hmm. I used to fly to the center. I'm going directly at them. That's the shortest distance. I'm going 7 miles a minute, 420 knots is what I used to fly. And then they don't know what heading I'm going to go when I leave the top. So they have to look for me first. And in that amount of look, I'm pretty much gone again. And I'm tail on, which is their smallest aspect. Mm-hmm. So I used to go due west to go in, and then I would go to the first SAM site, because we had to penetrate the envelope. You had to penetrate. In the north, the entire coastline was covered with these circles representing the envelopes for all of these different SAM sites, with multiple SAM sites, of course, in the heavily defended areas. And I just would fly to the center, until we could get through them. And we'd go to our target, which, you know, you were going to be defended against there anyway. You had no choice. You had to go. But I would make feints, when I say I, as a crew. There were a couple times when we were targeted for some target which was very, very close to downtown Hanoi. And we would fly straight to downtown and make a very, very hard turn, 120, 130 degrees of turn, and come back with less than 1 minute now for run-in for the target, for the BN to do all of this work. So I was putting some tremendous pressure on him to do that, but neither were we heavily defended. We were going to these heavily defended areas, but we were never actually shot at while we were there, because we were feinting. We were just trying to do our little bit to, you know, play games.
you inferred then you felt that the rules of engagement were a hindrance?
Yes. Again, it was perhaps not at the time that I was there.
But right. In retrospect.
Yeah, in retrospect. Yeah, I think definitely. I think that entire situation could have been started and been over with in 10 days if we had done the same thing we did in 75 and 60. We were sitting at peace tables for all those years with nothing happening. Basically just a little game of political game, give and take. And I mean, I remember coming into the ready room on May 1st, and there was a chalked note across the top. No looking north of 29 North. No looking north of 29 North. Some agreement that had been made prior to then, which got passed to the State Department, which got passed to the Secretary of Defense, which ultimately made it to our task force commander, was that, okay, well, we won't do any reconnaissance then. We won't do any reconnoitering. You know, we won't take pictures. We won't fly over your targets, you know, north of 29. We've got radar. The radar goes like this. If you fly along 29 North, it's going to look to the north. How do you tell a crew not to look there? And what are you going to do? You're going to just fly just south of 29 North and just, you're going to kind of go like this, but, oh, no, we're not supposed to look over there. Okay, just look forward. No, I mean, it was quite ridiculous. No looking north at 29 North. I remember, it was in chalk.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy.
Now, you said you served two tours?
I had the one prep tour, and then I had the tour on the Kitty Hawk. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see, what do I ask you? Did you have any R&R?
R&R. Yes, we did.
Where did you go?
Well, we went. We all of us always had to go. If we were going to go to Japan, we had to go to the Philippines, and that's to sanitize. That was the term that was used. We had to sanitize. Basically, take off things we weren't supposed to take to Japan by forces of agreement.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
You know, things that you can't confirm nor deny you have, but you got to go there, make believe you take them off. Okay. And so, Philippines, Hong Kong, one time, and Yokosuka, Japan, which would give you the ability to, you know, hop on a train and go to Tokyo and do stuff like that. But never the opportunity to go to, for example, Australia. I tried when the ship was going to go to Hong Kong. They had to come down to, like I say, came down to Kibi Point in the Philippines first, and I got off the ship there and tried to get a flight, and I went over to, from Clark Air Force Base, I went over to Saigon, and I arrived in Saigon at the beginning of the Tet Offensive. Great timing. Here I am, I've been safe in a cockpit, air-conditioned cockpit of an airplane, and I arrived with mortar shells, you know, flying overhead, and rockets, and generals saying, here's my gun, and, you know, come with me in this Jeep if you want to cross the field. All that, it was just, so I had to get out of there, so guess where I ended up going? The only airplane out of Saigon was going to Da Nang, which was even worse. And I finally got on a EC-121 and got right back to Clark Air Force Base where I started. And then I ended up catching a civilian flight to Taipei and caught the ship in Hong Kong like the day before we left. So I was trying to, I mean, I came very, very close to getting on a 707 that was going from Da Nang to Australia. And there was one young Marine who, I think he was number 59, who hadn't answered up. Everybody else, the tarmac was almost 2 miles wide where you had. And so the Marine gunny sergeant, he said, well, if somebody doesn't show up, I talked my way, sweet talked my way, and if somebody doesn't show up, okay, I guess you can have their seat. And I'm standing at the ladder, and this one that they kept calling for number 59. And so finally the pilot said, well, if you're going to go, you better go now. And I went back, and here coming lumbering across the ramp, carrying his little sea bag, was this Marine. I said, number 59? He said, yeah. I said, have a good time. And we crossed, and I continued my egress from Vietnam.
Do you ever see any USO shows?
No, no, not on that cruise. Mm-hmm. That was pretty serious business over there. The USO shows, I've been on carriers in the Mediterranean when they've had them, but and we also had the longest recorded line period. When we were over on the Kitty Hawk, normally they rotate you maybe every 30, 40 days or something like that. That's the longest you're on. And you got to sign what's called red, white, or blue carrier, the carriers that were there. They generally had two carriers on station. And you were going to fly noon to midnight, midnight to noon, or I guess it was all daylight, whatever it would be, some other third situation. And I've forgotten which ones were which, but one red, one white, one blue. But the Pueblo incident occurred in the South China Sea when just a few days before we were supposed to be relieved by the Enterprise. So the Enterprise stayed up in the South China Sea, and we ended up taking her time. So we were on the line, I think, for, well, it was in excess of 60 days. We pretty much fly combat sorties every day, and it was pretty rigorous, pretty tiring. You know, just you go to bed and you fall asleep with your eyes wide open, knowing that you're going to wake up the next day and you're going to be on the flight schedule and you're going to go do it again.
Were there ever any guys that, I guess, couldn't fly because of that?
They probably did, and probably none of the other guys knew about it. They were probably just didn't show up on the schedule that day or something by agreement with the CO. But our squadron, there were other issues, and I'm not even going to go into them here. It's just not appropriate. There were reliable crews, and there were not reliable crews. Let's just put it that way. But we had sister squadrons. Things were so bad, losing aircraft and losing crews that were, you know, missing in action or confirmed POWs and so on. And in a two-week period, there was our sister squadron over there on the Enterprise. They had three crews, six people, turn in their wings. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, send me home, I'm not going to do this anymore. And, you know, that's another interesting aspect, is that, you know, afterwards you ask yourself, you know, okay, yeah, at the time you think, hey, what's wrong with him? I mean, he got trained to do this, he's been taking flight pay, and that's his job, and, you know, what a wimp. I mean, that's not the word we use.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, years later you think about the fact that, you know, maybe he was a smart guy. Yeah, maybe he was a smart one. Maybe, you know, family and living a long life was more important than flight pay and what his, you know, colleagues in the Navy were going to say about it. Hard one, especially because of the war. I don't think that would have been the same discussion, for example, during World War II. I'm just imagining, mm-hmm. but I just mm-hmm. I don't think that would have come up that way.
Now, when were you in Vietnam? What were you? What years?
67,
68. That book I talked about, the Launch the Intruder, yeah. They talked about some race issues on the cruise and the carrier. Did you have any at your
None.
Time?
No, as a matter of fact, the Kitty Hawk did have a race riot on it several years after we came back. Mm-hmm. I mean, it made the news and it was quelled. I mean, mm-hmm. they were at sea. I think there were like 12 or 14, you know, black sailors who, I don't know what they did. They took the ship store, the post mm-hmm. office, but it was bad, but it was, no, we didn't have that type of problem. In fact, to my knowledge, most of the time in the military, that's never been an issue in the military for some reason. Mm-hmm. Just guys accept each other. How you did your job had nothing to do with the color of your skin. Honest to gosh. I mean, mm-hmm. I've trained a couple of black bombardier navigators. Tried to train an Indian, when I say Indian, from the country of India. Their culture made it difficult. They don't train the way we do. You can't criticize. Mm-hmm. And of course, in our culture, you know, that's the worst flight I've ever seen. You know, and that's you always have to give them an out. They have to save mm-hmm. face, and that doesn't work in our training system.
Mm-hmm. Were you aware of the anti-war movement going on back home?
Not really. No. It wasn't until, you see, prior to our crews going home, and again, because I arrived, you know, a couple weeks late, this other crew and I, we rode the ship back, mm-hmm. and they were able to come back on what would have been what's called the red carpet flight. Prior to our cruise, the air crew all came back. They were came back on red carpet flight, free-flowing champagne, you know, free-flowing steward eye. Came back to news press. They were all taking flash pictures, and everybody was happy. It was all, you know, welcome home, mm-hmm. you know, warrior. And by the time mid-68 arrived, the war movement had made such an impact that the word was, okay, first of all, no red carpet flight. Okay, when you come back, you know, you don't wear a uniform. You know, you wear civilian clothes. You don't talk about it. You just blend into the community. You know, come to work in your civilian clothes, put a uniform on, you know, when you're back in the hangar. I mean, it was different. And you want me to embellish on that?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, years later, after I was out of the service, I instructed in the A6 still as a civilian. And one of my students was the son of one of my squadron mates from that Vietnam tour that I was telling about on the Kitty Hawk. And he was coming back from, I had trained about 250 students at the, just prior to Desert Storm. And he was coming back on America from a tour in America in Desert Storm. And I remember being there on the pier with his dad. And then I remember him coming down the brow and getting us and taking us to the wardroom and sitting across the table from us. And first of all, Norm and I had tears in our eyes when the ship was coming in. I mean, they were playing God Bless America and it was just, and the, you know, the flag and the ship coming in. It was very, very touching. And anyway, we went down to the wardroom, and I remember this young fellow saying that, and how wise and perceptive of him to even be able to know this, to say it. But he said, "Dad, Stu," he said, this homecoming is as much for you guys as for me and my squadron mates, because we never got our welcome home.
What did you do from 68 to 80 when you left the service?
I could just, what I remember when I told you early on, I said much to my, whatever I said, what the word was about, I never made it past Lieutenant Commander. Mm-hmm. I made a choice to stay in the cockpit. And the military wants you to want to be, you know, somebody who goes to the Pentagon or goes to a joint staff or becomes, and by doing so, I, you know, pretty much took myself out of the competition to make further rank. But I did stay in the cockpit. I was current the entire time I was in the service. I have flight time in, like I said, in all the variants of the A6. I have some flight time in the F-14, in the P-3, C-12. I mean, I got, even on my very first tour in the Navy, I got qualified in a helicopter in an H-3 for a day in the Hilo. So I was always just interested in flying. Once I realized that that was something that I enjoyed and was good at and was recognized as being good at, that's what I, and I taught, I loved to teach flying. And so every other tour I had, I was an instructor. And then I also had a tour mid-career as an aircraft accident investigator, but I stayed teaching the aircraft because I dual-hatted when I was at the Naval Safety Center. I was also the A6 analyst, and that allowed me to fly with all the squadrons on the East Coast and the West Coast, Navy and Marine, and I did that. And I just did that in between doing accidents, doing investigations. I also was an investigator for 2.5 years after I got out of the service. Went back to that same shop as a civilian.
Okay. Did you ever stay in contact with anyone that served with you after you...
We have reunions every... I'm going to a reunion in May. Okay. The squadron is really, really tight, and we have a great historian, and he keeps us informed. We get a nice, long Christmas synopsis of whatever anybody has sent in. We do.
How do you think your time in the service changed or had an effect on your life?
Oh, wow, that's an interesting question. My time in the service affect my life, because I'm not close friends with any of my colleagues, but I mean we're all buddies, we're all tight that way. I think I was disciplined before I went into service, so I can't say that I learned, you know, an additional discipline. I loved flying, and it taught me that I liked to teach. I didn't travel and see the world. I was stationed at Oceania in Virginia Beach my entire time, you know, when I was not deployed. I never moved, you know, I never was sent elsewhere. I'm sure that it has had, you know, but many positive impacts. I just can't put any finger on it.
Yeah. All right. All right. Well, thank you very much for your interview.
Thank you.
You just made it.